morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, May 13th, and here are some of the stories we are following. Analysts say Africa will feel the impact of this year's U.S. presidential election.
I think that any new American president is going to have to grapple with the declining influence that Washington has on the continent of Africa and how much more African countries are asserting their own rights and privileges and speaking increasingly with one voice.
The U.S. Attorney General receives a petition to reopen a probe into the purchase of a lucrative oil field in Nigeria. A leading member of South Sudan's so-called peace holdout groups calls for a serious dialogue. The party of Charles Prime Minister Success Masra is demanding the immediate release of party members and activists.
No citizen should be arrested for coming and watching in attempt to ban the voting process. It's a citizen's right to ensure that the election process is as transparent as it can be.
And the World Health Organization says Africa has a shortage of health care workers. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Foreign policy issues rarely motivate U.S. voters, and for most Americans looking at their choices for president in November, Africa policy is not a huge consideration. But analysts say whichever candidate wins will face a stiff challenge in trying to restore America's influence and prestige in Africa, home to more than 1.2 billion people. We get the details from VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell in Washington.
Africa is not a monolith. It holds a dizzying wealth of history, resources, and traditions, and the full spectrum of struggles faced by many young nation states. And while the world's fastest growing continent plays a relatively small role on this stage, the person who next lives at the White House, whether that is former Republican President Donald Trump or Democratic President Joe Biden, will need to make policy choices that address the fast-changing economic and security conditions in Africa. Trump's past Africa stance, they say, can be summed up with one unprintable word he allegedly used to describe African countries and the Caribbean nation of Haiti. Michael Walsh is an Africa analyst at the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
I mean, he used famously this expletive to refer to a number of countries in Africa, and then he pursued a strategy and a policy that was really focused on trying to look at, you know, the burning issues in Africa, the security issues, the hot issues, and trying to stamp those out. But there really wasn't a larger grand strategy.
Biden has emphasized values-driven partnership on the continent. But much of that has been overshadowed by his administration's push against Russian influence in Africa and U.S. support of Israel. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think Africans are also looking well beyond our policies in Africa, looking at the war in the Middle East, the war in Gaza, and U.S. support to Israel, for example, or the demands that African countries not do business with or engage in relations with Russia. So I think they're seeing a certain degree of hypocrisy in the Biden administration's policies globally, and that's not making them many new friends in Africa.
This is something South Africa highlighted in accusing Israel of breaching the United Nations Genocide Convention with a landmark case at the UN's top court. The Biden administration, when asked by VOA in January, dismissed the case as meritless. Analysts say this shot at America's credibility invites adversaries to take advantage. Mariette Mabrouk studies Egypt and the Horn of Africa at the Middle East Institute.
You're going to need that credibility because at one point someone is going to say, another superpower is going to step in and say, right, I'm not being preferential. I earnestly do not care about human rights in any part of the world, and therefore, at least, that makes me better.
Hudson says the next U.S. president will meet an increasingly emboldened continent.
I think that any new American president is going to have to grapple with the declining influence that Washington has on the continent of Africa, and how much more African countries are asserting their own rights and privileges and speaking increasingly with one voice.
There may be a way to help turn that tide by tackling an oversight both candidates share. Candidates' wives have made official visits to Kenya, Namibia, Egypt, and Malawi, while President Biden dispatched Vice President Kamala Harris to Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia. However, neither he nor Trump has paid the continent a visit as president. Anita Palvio, News, Washington.
Two powerful U.S. lawmakers have petitioned Attorney General Merrick Garland to reopen a probe into the purchase of a lucrative oil field in Nigeria by oil giants Shell and Eni. Representative Maxine Walters, ranking member of Financial Services Committee, and Joyce Beattie on the National Security and Illicit Finance Committee alleged a payment of $1.1 billion to senior government officials to facilitate the deal. Nimo Basse is executive director of the ecological think tank, the Health of Mother Earth Foundation. He tells VOA's Chinedu Ofor that officials indicted in the probe should be prosecuted.
The matter concerning the oil block 245 has been on the front burner for a long time. Really one of the biggest bribery scandals in the history of the fossil fuel industry. Making this bold call highlights the fact that this matter has to be resolved in a way that sends a strong message to international oil companies and oil companies around the world who think nothing of the environment or the people or the quality of life, but only profit, but profit from bribery. I mean, this is really scandalous.
Are you surprised that it is taking some U.S. lawmakers to push and continue to ask for accountability on this matter instead of the Nigerian government?
Well, first of all, I want to applaud the U.S. lawmakers for making this very strong demand and keeping it in front of everyone. This because the oil corporations are completely in bed with the governments in Nigeria. And so it's very difficult, it's extremely difficult for government to stand up and confront these big giants, because government of Nigeria depends on the same oil companies for a whole big chunk of foreign exchange earnings they use to run their budget. And this is why having this external voice is extremely valuable.
This report paints a very, very uncomplimentary picture of the administration of former President Goodluck Jonathan, who is from the Niger Delta, and who at that point in time, his administration claimed to be the champion of not just cleaning up the Niger Delta, but also taking care of its own people.
For one thing, the leaders in the Niger Delta have always had a responsibility to ensure that the people have a fair deal. We have politicians in Niger Delta calling for action to restore the environment, remediate the environment, because we've had 70 years of reckless exploitation. Of course, the government of President Jonathan did not do enough in this regard. For example, it was under his tenure that the Ogoni report was issued by UNEP, United Nations Environment Program, that highlighted how deep pollution was in the area, but then that his government did not do much to commence the cleanup, although it set up a body that could do that. So I would say that it's embarrassing that these fingers can be pointed to an ex-president from the Niger Delta. It's a big embarrassment. The best hope I would have is that he would be able to stand up and clear his name and show that he's not as corrupt as is being alleged. In all that, I believe that it is right to hold politicians accountable for whatever they do, whether they're from the Niger Delta, whether they're from the oil belt, or from anywhere else in Nigeria or any other place in the world.
Nimo Basse is the executive director of the ecological think tank Health of Mother Earth Foundation. He was speaking from Benin City, Nigeria, with VOA's Chinedu Ofor. Chad's opposition Transformers Party of Prime Minister Success Masra is demanding the immediate release of party members and activists arrested over the weekend by Chadian security. The French news agency AFP reports that 67 activists were arrested on allegations of forgery and using false documents during last week's presidential election. Military junta leader and interim president Mohamed Idriss Debit Inno was declared winner with 61.03%. Ndolemaye Njesada is the Transformers vice president for political affairs and the diaspora. He tells me the 179 arrested activists were carrying out their constitutional duty to observe the election.
We do not know why they are arrested, but as far as the number that come to us as far as yesterday, we have about 179 people arrested and jailed as we speak. So we are asking for the freedom immediately, because there is no reason to arrest peaceful citizens who came out to be citizen watcher during the election process and ended up being put in jail. So this is not acceptable, and we are asking for the liberation immediately.
You say you do not know why they were arrested, but according to one article I read, some of your activists were arrested because they allegedly forged access cards for different voting stations. Is that true?
As a citizen, you do not need any access card to be observer. You do not have to have a specific document to observe the voting process. So regardless of what is being put out there, regardless of the narrative, no citizen should be arrested for coming and watching, in a sense, surveying the voting process. It's a citizen right to ensure that the election process is as transparent as it can be, because the electoral law authorizes citizens to observe. Because at the end of the day, after the voting are closed, the administrator of the voting process are required to count out loud every vote, so that anybody who's there should be able to see.
The results have been announced, and General Debbie Itno has won 61% of the vote, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Masra, has 18.5% of the vote. Does your party agree with these results?
Well, if we agree, we should be doing something in that sense. We have the right as a political party to have all the copy of the procedure log to double-check. That's what we are requesting it, but we haven't had it yet. And yet the law authorizes each candidate can have a copy of that. And on top of that, our candidate is the current prime minister of the country. So as the head of the government, he has the right to have access to that. But as of today, we do not have officially access to the count in order for us to double-check to ensure that things are done in transparency.
So you mentioned your candidate is the current prime minister. Let's assume that the results stand. Is he still going to be prime minister in the government?
Well, I don't think that's the question to ask at the moment. Right now, we are in a crisis at the moment. So it's important to take one step at a time. This fight is not about being a prime minister. This fight is about freedom of the charging and respecting the desire of the people. And as you can see throughout the campaign, the people of Chad need real change. And in order to do so, the voices have to be respected. It is not about being a prime minister or being a minister in the upcoming government. That's not the point. Those who are focusing on that are missing the point. The point is to bring true justice and equality for the Chadian people, and that's where our focus is, not focus on a position in a government.
Dilemba Jesada is the Vice President for Political Affairs in the Diaspora of Chad's Opposition Transformers Party. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, May 13th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Something O'Malley Sports. A leading member of South Sudan's so-called peace holdout group said the country needs a serious dialogue to discuss the root causes of its problems. The holdouts are armed groups that have yet to ratify the 2018 revitalized comprehensive peace agreement. Pagan Amon spoke as Kenyan President William Ruto officially launched a mediation process on Thursday to bring about peace between the South Sudan government and the lagging groups. The talks have been taking place in recent years in Rome. Amang tells me that the holdouts want to reform the country and put it on the path to democratic transformation and development.
Opposition and in the National Consensus Forum, we see this initiative, which President Ruto calls it Hope Initiative. We see it as probably the last opportunity to rescue South Sudan and avoid its disintegration into chaos and disorder. We believe this should be a chance for South Sudanese to engage in a serious dialogue with the aim to develop national consensus and agree to a new social contract that could be the basis of a state and nation building in South Sudan.
So if I understand, your group is the one that has not yet ratified the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. Because when you say you need dialogue, what is it that you want?
What we want is for South Sudanese stakeholders to sit together, agree on how to build the South Sudanese state, how to agree on the relationship and define the relationship between the citizens and their state, and what type of a state that we want to have. Definitely the people of South Sudan struggled to have their own state, to be independent, and the purpose was to build a state that can deliver on all the promises of the liberation struggle that we have waged from generation to generation. That is what is needed. What we actually want is to rescue South Sudan. South Sudan today is not only a fragile state, it is actually collapsing into chaos and disorder. We need to rescue it for us to have a state.
Do you want to be a part of this government? Otherwise, what do you say to those South Sudanese who say a group like yours are peace spoilers?
There is no peace in South Sudan to spoil. The peace in South Sudan has been destroyed and it is spoiled already by the current government and the parties that have been engaged in violent power struggle, which has taken tribal lines and which has resulted into the killing and the death of hundreds of thousands of our people, and displacement of millions into refuge outside the countries and millions inside the country.
Would you agree that perhaps one place to start from to build this peaceful South Sudan is to have an election, which is scheduled for the end of this year? Do you think South Sudan is ready for election this year?
No. These elections are a joke. After all, there is no constitution that defines the structures of government and even articulate clearly what are the electable positions. Secondly, the environment in the country with the rampant violence that is all over the place, there are no conditions for a peaceful election.
Pagan Among is the leading member of armed groups that make up South Sudan's so-called peace holdouts. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. The World Health Organization, WHO, says Africa has a shortage of healthcare workers. The issue was addressed in Namibia last week at a forum in the capital, Windhoek. Vitalia Angula reports.
Speaking at the first WHO Africa Health Workforce Forum held in the capital, Namibia's Minister of Health and Social Services, Kalumbi Shangula, warned that Africa's shortage of health workers will impede the continent from achieving universal health coverage by 2030. In order to reach universal health coverage by 2030, as envisaged in the United Nations Sustainable Goals Report, Africa needs to invest in training programs, offer incentives for health practitioners to remain in their home countries, and create initiatives to attract health professionals in the diaspora back to the continent. Shangula spoke at the World Health Workforce Investment Charter event.
The number of Africans who have left the continent in search of greener pasture in other parts of the world are staggering. It is a matter that needs to be addressed as a top priority for African governments. And indeed, all those who wish to see a shift in the historical as well as current trend.
Africa has a ratio of 1.55 health workers per 1,000 people. That is below the recommended WHO threshold of 4.55 health workers per 1,000 people. Africa's Center for Disease Control Director General Jill Kesaya says achieving universal health coverage by 2030 will require an additional 1.8 million health workers on the continent. He says the critical shortage is projected to reach about 6.1 million by 2030 and is made worse by recurrent public health emergencies faced by countries on a daily basis.
In 2023 alone, Africa recorded 166 outbreaks. And the trend I see in 2024 is not good. EU member states are far from realizing the 2017 African Union Assembly decision that called for rapid recruitment, training, and deployment of 2 million community health workers by 2030.
Global Health Director for the Africa Diaspora Development Institute, ADDI, Lee Whitaker, says the institution has opened doors for diasporan health workers to return to Africa and reverse the brain drain. He says the organization has access to over 45,000 Black African physicians in America and only needs an invitation from the heart of any African state to come abroad. Dr. Avikana Chihombori is the president of ADDI, an organization that is mobilizing the African diaspora to return and invest in the continent.
Let the diaspora come in and invest in for-profit clinics in Africa as well as for volunteer work in Africa. It has to be balanced.
The forum, which was attended by health dignitaries from all over the world, concluded with the launch of the Africa Health Workforce Investment Charter that aims to mobilize and sustain development, performance, and retention of the health workforce in African Union countries. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa's portion. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the CAF Confederations Cup Finals. Morocco's RS Berkane will head to next weekend's CAF Confederations Cup Final second leg with a one-goal advantage after edging Zamalek of Egypt 2-1 in the first leg of the double-legged affair at the Berkane Municipal Stadium on Sunday evening. First half goals by captain Yusufu Dayo as well as Adil Tahif ensured the two-time champions head to Cairo with a slender lead for what promises to be a highly entertaining second leg final in Egypt. In basketball news, Ballard du Sport, located in Trècheville, Côte d'Ivoire, will play host to the Zone 3 FIBA Africa Under 18 qualifiers for men and women from July 8th to the 18th, ahead of the final round billed for Pretoria, South Africa. Eight national under 18 teams from the West African region, Zone 3, are expected for each category. Benin, Burkina Faso, Côte d'Ivoire, Ghana, Liberia, Niger, Nigeria, and Togo will battle to qualify for the final round. The 2024 FIBA Under 18 African Championships serves as a qualifier for the 2025 FIBA Under 19 Basketball World Cup. Staying with basketball, AS Douanes clinched the last ticket for the 2024 Basketball Africa League playoffs thanks to a comprehensive 79-54 win over Rwanda's APR on Sunday at Dakar Arena, Senegal. With the win, AS Douanes closed their Sahara Conference with a 3-3 record. APR, on the other hand, became the first Rwandan side to be eliminated in the group stages. With the win, AS Douanes secured the last playoffs ticket, joining Al Hakli SC of Egypt, Al Hali of Libya, FUS Rabat of Morocco, Rivers Hoopers of Nigeria, Petro de Luanda of Angola, Cape Town Tigers of South Africa, and US Monastery of Tunisia. The 2024 BAL playoffs will run from May 24th to June the 1st at the BK Arena in the Rwandan capital. In athletics, Ivorian Marie-Josée Toulouse-Smith produced a scintillating run to win the women's 100 meters in 10.91 seconds at the Jamaica Athletics Invitational Meet, a World Athletics Continental Tour Silver event on Saturday. Toulouse-Smith, making her individual season debut, moved to third on this season's award list. She got a decent start and went into overdrive at the halfway stage before going on to claim a clear win. In the 100 meters hurdles, Tobia Musson of Nigeria, the world record holder in the women's 100 meters hurdles, was the fastest over the barriers, setting a world leading time of 12.40 seconds. Danielle Williams, a two-time world champion, was ahead for most of the race but lost her rhythm over the final two hurdles and finished second in 12.46 seconds. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, May 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.